order. According to the agenda, we will go down the items as printed, which would be House Bill 3184, 3178, and 3162 as far as consideration. There will be some movement in and out here today. I know that Representative Shields has mentioned that he needs to go testify on a bill that he has. I will be moving out at some point as well. So with apologies in advance and with your understanding and cooperation, we will muddle through. So with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3184. Thank you very much. Mr. Keller, will you give us an overview, please?
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 3184, it directs the State Board of Education to enter an order to merge existing education service districts based on specified criteria. There is a dash one amendment attached. This is a replacement language for the entire bill. It relates to the funds that ESDs generate through entrepreneurial endeavors. The staff measure summary is attached. There was a letter sent to the Speaker's office asking or requesting permission to remove the referral to the House of Revenue, which is included. There was a revenue impact statement, fiscal impact statement. And the last document is some selective readings from the chalkboard. We received a notebook a couple months ago. And on the second page, under policy option number two, eliminate transportation matching fund. Oops, I'm sorry, wrong one.
Never mind. Page one.
Page one. Critically assess the efficiency of Oregon's education service district. Consider methods to increase school district participation in the development of ESD services.
Thank you. And you will recall that from the, I know, in-depth reading that you all have had with the end report from the House Interim Committee, one of those areas of address was accountability, ESDs, and this does not, again, address the elimination or reorganization. It is an accountability piece in how they contract. So I have no one signed up to testify for House Bill 3184. Is there anyone in attendance before I before we close the door on that opportunity? Okay. Then in order to discuss this, I think maybe we'll move it into a work session and have some discussion. So we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3184 and open a work session on House Bill 3184. And to bring it then further into the proper role of the discussion, perhaps we'll address the dash one amendments at this point.
Madam Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 3184.
Representative Dahlem has moved the dash one amendments to House Bill 3184. Discussion. Representative March?
Yes, if I could maybe get from the committee administrator, if possible, what kinds of services are sort of included under this entrepreneurial services category that we're now putting in statute here?
As my staff measure summary indicates, we receive funds not only through the state school fund, but also through contracts, grants, private sources, and then anything else or any other method that they use to generate funds, those will be classified as entrepreneurial. We've heard testimony in the past where they went into the cell phone business, printing business, food service, transportation, those types of endeavors. Mm-hmm.
Other questions or discussion, Representative Paul?
With the chairman's permission, there are even more heroic enterprise issues. For example, the ESD here, when the electric companies saved a portion of rates to refit schools, this ESD put together a package and went around the state, reworking windows, reworking light fixtures, that sort of thing. And because they had a crew that did that continually, that enterprise activity was very valuable, not only to this ESD, but to schools that purchased that service. We were able to save large amounts of money. Enterprise services are all over the place. Representative March, I think that what we're talking about is any idea that would save schools money or allow them to execute an educational activity or a contractual activity that is better done in a group fashion than individually could be qualified as enterprise.
Okay, so to follow up then, if they can do that now under the current system, what's the purpose of these?
And if I might, again, it seems to me there were two issues that have created great consternation about ESDs. One of the ESDs had contracted to do alternative ed. And in doing alternative ed, they offered, just as I explained to you, local districts an option to provide alternative ed services at a much cheaper level. However, in doing that, their count on students was somewhat questionable. Now, before they started on that enterprise district, the enterprise issue would be put before the local boards first and sold second. Here it had been sold first and then went to the local board for approval.
If I might enhance somewhat a little further, Representative March, normal contract services subject ESDs to what is called a resolution process. They submit their proposals to their reviewing authority, which is the board. And this also moves their entrepreneurial endeavors and contracting, therefore, into the same process. And as an oversight and accountability effort. Does that address your concerns, Representative Roble? Well, it's an explanation, but
I'll follow up on that same line. So in a case like that, that Representative Dolan was talking about, this district gets entrepreneurial. I think our ESD has done some stuff with finances. They'll actually do the books for schools that can have some stuff. So, but let's say they're doing these outside now. And the local districts don't really appreciate that they're helping these others. So they say, it goes to them and they say, no, we're not going to let you do it outside. Then it's done?
That's the end of the game.
Okay. So it actually could eliminate things that are now being done, like the fixing windows and that kind of stuff. If the local school districts decided they didn't want them to do that, then by doing this they could say, sorry, you aren't going to have that opportunity.
That could happen, but it does offer a second pair of eyes, a second set of elected officials. The question I think raised is, who are the ESDs accountable to? And they are accountable to the local districts on resolution services.
We did have an example as well. I think it was early in the interim. Willamette ESD that had contracted in competition for printing services in competition with Salem Kaiser, as I recall, and ultimately had, how do you say, in de parlance, gone broke.
Right, yeah.
So that is a concern, those types of endeavors, just having a little bit more of an overview.
So is it the same kind of voting that is done? Follow-up, Manager.
So we're discussing
okay,
here.
Yeah. Is it the same kind of structure that we do with the resolution service, that either 50% of the school district or those representing 50% of the population plus one or something? Is it the same mechanism for would have to approve it?
Okay. Representative Clark, is that your understanding as well?
That is my understanding, and I just was curious to know. So, John, I'm sorry, Representative Dolan, in your we don't get that informal in this committee, or in any other committee. When it talks about the component school districts, can you give an example? And you may have in your previous testimony, but I missed it.
The district I represent has several ESDs. In Region 9 ESD, this would be Hood River, the Dalles Wetonka, Maupin, and Duford. And they are accustomed to coming before local boards and laying out the resolution services. Jefferson County, coincidentally, it would be Jefferson County. The ESD is the school district. But they're very accustomed to coming before the board and laying out resolution services. In fact, superintendents meet in most of the ESDs I've been involved with and determine what resolution services are appropriate, and it is a long, protracted discussion.
Additional query, Representative Shield.
So the heart of this bill is it the intent to expand the capabilities of the ESDs to go after other work or to restrict?
Well, I would suggest that it just, depending upon the motivation, I guess, of the entrepreneurial spirit of the individual ESDs, it just brings them into an accounting process, an overview process that's a little bit more in line with the other processes that they go through in their contracting endeavors. This one happens to be entrepreneurial, puts them in their same mode as their other contract processes. So I don't know that it would have a dampening effect, or I can't say as to whether it would have an expanding effect to directly answer your question. It just makes them accountable in the same manner that they are.
So what you're saying is an elected body then would have to approve what they're going to go after.
There already is in place, Representative Shields, an elected body, the ESD board. But we have had several entrepreneurial activities that seemed in some quarters to exceed the scope of what an ESD should do. I think that if the local boards agree that that entrepreneurial activity is good for them, good for the ESD, good for the school, then they can approve it and off we go. It puts one more step in the process. It makes what we call entrepreneurial services fall into the category of what are called resolution services. It gives oversight, if you will. I don't think it's really, there's really nothing new here, with the exception of moving entrepreneurial services under the same masthead as resolution services.
Representative Marks.
Thank you. And actually, if I read on page 2, section 1D, the services are approved each year through a resolution process described in ORS 334-175. So when I go to 334-175, it talks about special services and facilities within district. And then down in sub 2A, it talks about agreed upon on or before March 1 by resolution of 2/3 of the component school districts, which are part of the ESD, or districts in which have at least a majority of the pupils in the average daily membership of the education service district. So if I'm understanding this correctly, the city, Portland Public Schools, which probably has at least 51% of the students within Multnomah County's ESD, could object to services the Multnomah County ESD would be providing to David Douglas or Park Rose or Gresham Barlow, and could therefore stop any of those services from being performed.
They can already. Yes, there are some provisions to protect small schools. It has to be a majority of the students, a majority of the schools. And I'd have to read that again. I believe the idea of the ESD of the services provided is to do collectively what you can't do singularly, and the voting structure protects the large from the small and the small from the large. And works fairly well.
Representative Roblin, did you have a comment you wish to add to that?
I was just going to say there are times when, in fact, the largest group in a group has a lot more power with regard to what other things get offered. But that's the way it is for resolution services right now. All this does, as I read it, is to say that same standard has to be held for things they want to offer outside of their region, not just the ones in their region, because that's the law for the regular. It's just saying we need to use, as I'm hearing it.
Your understanding.
Yeah, and I think we had another little question here. I was just going to ask. Resolution services, are those services that the
there's a certain tax base, and there's certain things that the ESB provides. And they come and they say, which of these, they give you a list, which of these do your districts want to take mm-hmm. part in the ESB? And if they don't get that number, they don't provide them as part of their resolution services. Then there's other services you can contract with, which is what this is about. And most of us contract for different things that ESD will provide as well, separate from the resolution. The resolution services are just those that are taken out of their tax base.
All right. Okay. That's the difference between. Primarily process is what we're addressing here.
This appears to be mostly process.
Yeah.
Do we have any representative from the ESDs here?
Is there anyone from... Would you like to come forward and comment on this?
I actually came in a little bit late, so I'm not so far.
As you can tell from the test,
we're going to fine you for that.
Okay.
For the record, give us your name, please.
Pat Haley from Multnomah ESD. I'm actually here as part of a Lewis and Clark class. With Clem Mossberg, so thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Do you have any specific questions of me?
Have you had an opportunity to look at the -1 amendments to House Bill 3184?
I'm sorry, I have not.
Okay.
So.
We can get him a copy real quick.
We'll get you a copy real
thank
quick.
Thank you.
And Jim, do you want to just give him an overview, a verbal, as to what it does?
This is just taking those entrepreneurial endeavors mm-hmm. and put them through the resolution process.
Okay. The stories that we're being told over here about how ESDs work are essentially correct. There are, of course, those resolution services. Most of what I do, actually, at Multnomah ESD is through other sorts of things, either purchased services or through specialized contracts from Oregon Department of Ed. And so if you have some questions about how that might work or something, I'd be happy to respond. Yeah.
Representative Roblin.
You're kind of exactly where... what this bill talks about. So if, in fact, you have a service that you are providing at the ESD that, say, another district outside of your ESD region would like to purchase, currently, do you just go ahead and let them purchase it if you feel like it would be of advantage for your ESD?
If it's something that we actually have up and running, we may do that. We pay a lot more attention to our constituent districts. And the entrepreneurial move that kind of had swept through ESDs in the last few years really has not been embraced an awful lot by our superintendent, Ed Schmidt. We all were aware of the fact that that's been going on. But we're pretty busy with East County and with Portland and haven't reached out to do a lot of those entrepreneurial services, although I know it's out there.
So,
follow up.
So this bill basically says that you couldn't do it unless you went through the same process that you do for a resolution, i.e. get the board.
Mm-hmm.
Would you think that would be an appropriate thing for your ESD?
Check
for that first.
Well, I won't speak for the superintendent or the ESD, but personally, I think if there's some good services that are available, whoever the provider is, someone that wants to contract for those services should have that opportunity to do that. And likewise, if there are some specialized expertise, as an example, one of my programs deals with all the kids that are in the hospital programs, you know, in school but being served at Dornbecker or one of the hospitals. If someone else wants to purchase some specialized services or expertise around how to work with those kids, I think it would make some sense to give them the opportunity to do that.
Especially that case, having mm-hmm. had a couple of kids from Coos Bay who were at Dornbecker.
Sure.
And we did do that through you
uh-huh.
Because we couldn't figure out how to get all that education services happening. It certainly was I want to thank you. I didn't realize that was who it was.
Just luck of the draw.
Our kids at Dornbecker.
Mm-hmm.
So just say thanks for that. But if this bill were to pass, we would have had to take that to the resolution services ahead of time. We would have taken through this process ahead of time in order to buy the service.
The way I read the bill, Representative Roblin, is before Multnomah could offer that sort of an enterprise service,
they would
have to run it through their member boards, and your purchase of that enterprise product would be made available. Whether or not that product is offered is the penchant of the ESD and their member board.
Okay, thank you. That's good clarification.
And I actually, as another clarification, that particular program is actually funded through a special contract through long-term care and treatment dollars and hospital programs through the Department of Ed. It's a special contract. But I think there is a parallel to maybe other programs that you've laid out.
Any additional questions?
Yeah.
Representative March.
Well, so if there was such a case, and now obviously this doesn't 100% apply because the hospital situation is covered.
That's a pretty special case, yeah.
But if are there other services that are currently being purchased by other districts from your ESD?
From outside of our constituent districts? Not that I'm aware of. But, again, I have a rather narrow slice of the pie. I won't know my ESD.
Right. Yeah, you made the mistake of raising your hand.
Right, and this is only my second year there, so they haven't told me everything yet. So.
Okay.
Representative Dahl.
With your association with the ESDs, do all of them run exactly the same?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, I was the special ed director at Region 9 ESD when you were at Chenoweth, and just for a brief period of time. But each ESD really has a different flavor, a different different way that they respond to the needs of the community, because the community has so many different needs, and that's one of the things that I think is the strength of the ESD format, is that they're able to provide what is needed for those local districts, and what's needed in the Dalles or Chenoweth or out at Mosier is really different than what may be needed in Gresham or in Portland, and to have those two have to follow exactly the same format I think would be a mistake.
Do you see this bill? Well, thank you, Madam. Do you see this bill in any way inhibiting the things that Region 9 did?
Again, Region 9 was not extremely entrepreneurial, and so I don't know that it would at that point. And again, I saw the special ed piece, and that was about all during my time there. So,
thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you
for stepping forward. Oh. Well, coming forward when called upon.
Thank you.
Representative Dahlem has, we've discussed, he's moved the Dash 1 amendments. Is there any objection to the moving the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3184? Seeing none, then so moved.
Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3184 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 3184 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue be rescinded. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair, I would be more than happy to say that I'm a little uncomfortable with this bill at this stage. It sounds from the talk here, it sounds like a bill in search of a problem that may or may not exist. And given the onerous having to decide by March 1. What services may be offered in the next year, and having going through the resolution process presents potentially some difficulties for districts in special situations. So I'll be a no on this bill.
Thank you. Any further comments?
Yes.
Representative Shield and Representative Provost.
I'd be inclined to vote yes on this, I think, but I think at this point I would like to get a little more feedback, and I think I'll also be voting no because I think I need a little more work on getting over the hump on it.
Okay. Representative Roblin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I actually like the concept. My concern is that I haven't had a chance to talk to two of my districts, which I know are relatively entrepreneurial. And so, I mean, the Coos Furry ESD and the Lane County ESD are both ones. Actually, we buy services from Douglas as well. So I'm concerned that I might be cutting off, and my district, opportunities that they might not get to have. So I'm am a little nervous about that right now. So I'm probably going to be a no on this one just because I want to see that. And I, if I had a chance to talk to those people, I might not be. So that's where I'm at right now. I just need to touch base with a couple of those people before I feel more comfortable.
Madam Chair, would it be a problem to move this to Friday's agenda?
We can do that. That will give you the opportunity to speak with your respective entities.
Be helpful, Madam.
Okay, very well.
We
Representative Dahlem, would you like to withdraw your
motion? I will withdraw my motion.
Okay. That would be the motion to move it to the floor. So withdrawn. And then we will close the work session on House Bill 3184. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3178. Mr. Keller?
Yes, ma'am. 3178 changes basis of the state school fund transportation grant from percentage of approved transportation costs of school district to amount based on amount received by school district in prior year. There is a dash one amendment. It changes the growth from 2% a year to 4%, and it would take effect in July of 2007.
Hey. Is that Michael Shields?
Madam Chairman, honorable committee members, Michael Shields, Salem Kaiser School District Transportation Director and Oregon Pupil Transportation Southwest Chapter President. Like to just indicate that in looking over the bill that there's issues that aren't addressed that I would have concerns about. Growing districts, when you have population increases, you're building new buildings to base it on the prior year would not and the percentage would not adjust to those costs. There's students that oftentimes move in requiring unique services. We had a student move into Salem Kaiser that was burned over 80% of his body and required a special air-conditioned bus just for that student because his body didn't breathe properly. We have new programs and mandates, oftentimes that you have no control over as well, No Child Left Behind. We have 8 schools where we have to provide individual services to, and at any time those schools that may not hit those marks, that may go from 4 schools, it may go to 30 schools. And this bill would not address funding the transportation for those kids. There are inflation factors, as you're all aware. Several years ago, diesel fuel cost us 80 cents a gallon. It's close to $2 now. I've been watching that. 2 weeks ago, I was paying $2.21. It dropped to $2.06. It was up to $2.09. I mean, it's all over the board. This 4% doesn't address those kinds of economic conditions. If we were to put money in the bank on this, you know, then we'd all be rich in the stock market if we had that kind of predictions that 4% was going to be stable. The other piece is if those costs on an operation do increase because of those outside constraints, it then puts more of a burden back into the classroom because the local school district would then have to fund that out of the classroom, would increase classroom loads and other restrictions. Our special ed growth, special education transportation services, is about 8% annually because of the programs and the issues requiring those students. So I would just throw those thoughts to the committee for you to think about as we address this bill. There's a number of things, as I said, that I don't believe it includes or addresses. So I would entertain any questions at this time.
Representative Much.
Thank you. Mr. Shields, I agree with the intent of this bill in terms of trying to find efficiencies in the transportation system and finding the most efficient way to do that. Mm-hmm. And our current system, in theory, whatever you spend, we pay back. What kind of efficiencies do you look for in your system to make sure that the state's getting the best bang for the buck?
Our operation, I consider myself a businessman before I consider myself a school bus person, and we look at running it as a business. We look at our shop cost ratios. We look at there's routing concepts that you employ. We have decreased our mileage by over 200,000 miles in the last 3 years. There's techniques that can do things that could be. My thought, Representative March, would be to have if we're going to spend that kind of money, Oregon Department of Education, to have consultants that would go to smaller school districts that would help them with those routing concepts, with those maintenance techniques. We brought our tire repair into in-house, spent some money on some tire balancing equipment, reduced our tire expenditures by 15%. So you have to mark where you are, measure what it is, and look at the industry norms and move from there. And then there's those outside constraints you have no control over, as I said, with children moving in. But it has to be run like a business. And the intent is there. The intent is there. But the impacts, when you think through it from those perspectives, if you were running a business and somebody was to tell you, well, we're going to limit your income to 4% regardless of your sales, well, what would you say? Well, you have market conditions that are outside your control that you have, you know, you're not able to have any influence over.
To follow?
Follow up.
So if for the growing districts, like, for example, North Clackamas, which is a very rapidly growing
mm-hmm,
district,
mm-hmm.
this constraint could hurt their transportation?
North Clackamas, Beaverton, Salem-Keizer, we expect to grow 800 students. That's one middle school. That's five to seven big buses and three or four, five small buses for that population growth. So this bill doesn't address that kind of impact.
Thank you.
You bet.
Additional question, Representative Robles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on that same line, so the way I read that, then your assumption would be that those districts that were declining in enrollment and maybe could cut rents could continue to get a growth even though...
I noticed that possibility, yes, sir, Representative Rubel.
So, this one might be one of interest for me. We have all declining enrollments.
Additional questions for Mr. Shield? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tricia Smith, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I am here today to offer my opposition again to House Bill 3178 and the Dash 1 amendments. As I said in my earlier testimony, we believe that while it is an important and laudable goal to look for efficiencies in everything we do, we think that the transportation programs in schools may be one of those places where you actually can see what you're buying. Because the districts are reimbursed for actual costs, actual approved costs, they have to submit detailed accounting to the department. So it is easy for us to see what they're spending on transportation and whether or not we think that's appropriate. I think that the suggestion by the previous witness that if we want to help school districts become more efficient in their transportation program, the smaller districts could probably use some help in the form of Department of Education consulting in how to design a good transportation program. We told you, I think, in the last hearing that if our concern here is that there are too many managers in the bus program, we're happy to help with that as well. But as he said and we said in our earlier testimony, there are so many parts of a transportation program that are beyond the control of the district that to institute a program of if you change reimbursement to just a grant, then you divorce cost from that grant. And forevermore, then, you will be paying an amount of money that has no relationship to the cost of providing the service. Transportation is one of those places where you actually can pay what it costs, and no more and no less, if you choose. But this amendment will change that so that you will not know any longer what transportation costs and whether or not the grant that you're providing is adequate or too much.
Any questions for Ms. Smith? Thank you very much. Brian Reeder, please.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, I'm Brian Reeder. I'm the Director of Policy Research and Analysis Section at the Department of Education. First, I'd like to say that the department supports the intent of this bill. the idea of converting a reimbursement program to a grant, flat grant program that's based on some concept of true cost is one that provides an incentive for districts to be more efficient, and we think that's an important thing to do. We do have a couple concerns with the way the bill is currently written. They are the same concerns that Mr. Shields had. First of all, there's no provision made for growing districts. Simple 4% growth per year really has the effect of distributing more of the pie to declining enrollment districts and less of the pie to rapidly growing districts, and really would shortchange those districts who have more and more students to transport. We also have concern that a fixed growth rate of either 2% or 4% doesn't take into account conditions out in the real world where particularly energy costs fluctuate fairly dramatically from year to year. We do believe that both of these problems can be fixed. Tying the grant to some measure, some per student measure, as opposed to simply what the district got in a prior year in the aggregate would, I think, improve the ability of the grant to direct the appropriate amount to individual districts. And then perhaps tying the annual growth rate to an index of energy price, some concept of energy prices, so that it responds to market conditions, would also have some merit, and the department would be very happy to work with the committee to provide some amendments to move the bill in that direction.
Any questions for Representative Farr?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reeder, just for my information, or for the committee's information, I should restate that. How many school districts have their own transportation programs versus districts that contract out their transportation?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, I don't know that. I don't have that information. I don't think that Deborah Lincoln is in the room. She's the department's transportation director. But I don't have that. I apologize.
Can I follow up? Deborah Lincoln?
Oh, Deborah.
She is here.
You would like to have, if she has any information?
Yes, that would be great. That first and then I want to follow up.
For the record, Deborah Lincoln, Pupil Transportation Department of Ed. It's roughly a equal. It's a little more weighted. I can't tell you the exact number, but there's 199 districts, and it's a little heavier on the district or self-operation, but the other half would be contracted.
Okay. So follow-up.
Follow-up,
sorry. In looking at transportation costs, as a whole, what would be a reason that a district would choose to contract out their transportation services versus keeping it in-house?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, the reason that a district often goes into it is they don't want to be in the business of transporting children, and it does need to be run like a business. And sometimes they do find it's cheaper, because what they do is there's a special fund that they're supposed to be putting their bus depreciation when they purchase a school bus. We reimburse 10% a year, and it goes into a special fund that they can only purchase school buses. When they get out of the business of transporting children, they sell all their buses, so they get a one-time flush of money, and then they also can deplete that reimbursement fund and put that into the school. And that's only going to benefit them that one year when they sell their buses and they can use that funds. Sometimes districts feel, too, that when they're contracting, that they don't have to pay, they don't have to negotiate with the union, they don't have to pay a salary that's maybe higher, or they don't have to provide benefits or retirement, whereas the contractor usually pays somewhat less, has fewer benefits, and so a community has to decide, one, if they want to operate that way and do that to the people in the community, Also, when they lose control of their equipment and they lose control of the transportation, they then could become, I'm not saying that all contractors are like that, they could be then subject to any kind of inflation that the new contractor would want to pass on because they don't have any buses to go back to their own transportation. They also lose some ability to control the routing. Again, it depends on how the contract is written. But there are a good and bad to both sides.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Currently, in state law, we are required to provide transportation for students. And that's relatively new, is it not? Well, 10 or 15 years? Do you know?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin. Yes, it's been the late 80s right. That... It was the law was passed to require transportation. Before that, transportation was being provided, but one of the things districts was doing when they wanted a bond pass, if they couldn't get their constituents to pass it, then they would restrict or some kind of suspend transportation, say we won't do that. So the legislature at that time felt that because school buses are the safest form of transportation, I think I've provided that documentation to you before, that they wanted Oregon children to be on the safest form of transportation, and so it was mandated at that time that we'll provide transportation, and at that time it said, okay, we'll fund it 70%. And the idea was that they had to be somewhat responsible because they're spending some of their money, and then the state would help them out. It is similar to what other states also do. Idaho reimburses 80%. There's other states that do a similar thing. I also, just for your information, can tell you that some states have a very complicated formula that takes a great amount of effort on the part of the Department of Ed to administer or distribute the fund. The beauty of the 70% was that what you spend is what you get reimbursed. And I can just tell you from the visits that I regularly go on to transportation locations, they are not spending a lot of money. They are using the superintendent's leftover chairs. If you've been in those operations, they're not the kind of places that are just spending money frivolously.
Follow up. So what we're saying is the state passed a mandate back in the 80s, and with that mandate, instead of unfunding it, which happens to us from other places, they funded it at 70% with the assumption that that 30% was going to keep them being efficient because they whatever they can save, they save the money. And I guess the question is, if we change it this way, it appears to me that we're going to be passing on any additional costs back to the district. So we will not be living up to that 70-30% bargain that we made in the 80s. Would you see it the same way?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, yeah, I would see it that same way, that eventually the money is going to come from somewhere else, or if it's a declining district, they're going to be getting extra money and not really be spending it, so they're not going to be encouraged to be efficient at all.
Representative Marks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for either one of you, now, under No Child Left Behind, if a school falls into a certain category, the district must provide transportation to any student wishing to go to another school within that district. So if we, as a state, don't provide the additional funding for that, would we be in violation of state law under No Child Left Behind, or what, or is it the district that's in violation? What do you know? What kind of mechanism we'd be in there?
Chair Flores, Representative March, I believe the law requires the districts to transport those kids. It doesn't say anything about who should pay for it. So, you know, by not providing funding specifically for that activity, I don't believe the state would be in violation of any laws. But we may want to be concerned about the impact on the district of those additional costs.
To follow up then.
Follow up.
So then in our formula we might want to include something about districts that fall into that category. And then I was also thinking about the 00 school district, the McDermott School District and some of the other smaller school districts, Treasure Valley, whatever, where some of those have huge distance issues. So we'd probably want to include, besides per student and a growth and energy price formula, we'd want to provide something around distance and those kind of things. And the current system does a 70-30 with the incentive of, well, you get the, you know, you're 30%, you're putting in your own dollars as well.
Chair Flores, Representative March, I believe, and we've had this discussion at the department a number of times about, you know, how do you get the right amount of money to the right districts and the factors that affect their costs are obviously distance and the sparseness of the student population geographically that they serve and other factors. Now, I do believe that since this bill would use as its starting point current conditions, current reimbursement levels, that those districts that transport long distances and therefore have high per student costs, it starts them with that base in mind. So in some sense it takes into account those factors already. Now, to the extent that those may change over time, then the approach in this bill may take us further and further away from where we really want to be, which is to reimburse them for their true costs, but at the same time provide an incentive for them to be efficient by saying, if you can do it for less than this amount, then you can keep that money and use it for other things in the classroom. I mean, there would be nice if there were an easy answer to this, but there's not.
Further questions? Ms. Lincoln, when you use an example of the possibility of school districts losing control with the outside contractor and subject to any variation they might want to throw in the mix, has that ever occurred?
Chair Flores, what I hear is complaints from parents. And they'll say, well, they have to deal with the bus company, and the bus company has some kind of rule. I'm going to just pull one off the top of my head here on whether you could bring a skateboard on a bus or not, and not debating whether that's a safety issue or not. I'm just using that as an example. So the transportation company may have a rule like that, or they can't chew gum. That is maybe something that the district doesn't have, but the transportation office has. So I hear some little bit of complaints about that. Again, it's very location specific, and it depends on how involved the district wants to be. And there are some districts that have contractors that have their own district transportation liaison person. Everything goes through that. All the routing's approved for them. But again, the reason districts usually get out of the transportation business is they don't want to do routing, they don't want to do behavior management, they don't want to deal with the employees.
In a different context with the privately contracted entity, I think you indicated that they may come back to the school districts and increase their prices based on various factors. Does that happen?
Chair Flores, I can't tell you exactly where that would happen, but obviously they are a business and they have to increase their rates. So every time the contract is negotiated, they have to increase their rates.
Representative Roble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up on that question. You get the records because the cost per child of value, for transportation, every district is different. There's a lot of different other kinds of costs. Do you see a lot of difference between the cost of those that are being contracted and those that are not being contracted with respect to the OD's perspective?
Chair Flores, Representative Roble, I have not looked at the transportation expenditure data in that way, trying to compare districts that provide their own versus ones that contract out. I will say, though, that it's not a simple thing, because we don't observe costs. What we observe is expenditures. And so if we see a district that's spending more than another district, we don't know that their costs are higher. It could be that they're just less efficient. And so and that really is the point here, is trying to provide incentives for them to be more efficient. We don't have any evidence that there's widespread inefficiency out there, but at the same time, and I'll go back to the example that Mr. Shields made for Salem Kaiser, they run their transportation operation as a business, and if they can spend additional money on equipment that then saves them money, then they will do that. But I would suggest that the incentives that they face may still lead them to make poor decisions. And here's an example. If they were to purchase some equipment and they discovered that for every 50 cents they spent on that equipment, they could save a dollar in their expenditures, and any business would jump at that opportunity, but a school district would not, because for every dollar they save, they only get to keep 30 cents of it. So now the equation has changed. They spend 50 cents to save 30 cents, and that doesn't make sense to anybody. So what we have here is a system where the cost structure faced by an individual district is different than the cost structure faced by the system as a whole. And that's the source of these incentives that can lead them to not take advantage of savings that otherwise would make sense from a system-wide perspective. And so the intent of this bill is to make their incentives for each individual district the same as the incentives for the system as a whole. And, in sort of economic terms, that makes perfect sense. That's the reason that from a sheer efficiency standpoint, the department thinks this bill has some merit. And I know Deborah has some concerns about safety, where if it leads to more districts contracting out, and those companies are perceived as not having as qualified employees as the school district itself would have, and that may lead to less safe conditions, those are legitimate concerns.
Further questions? Representative Marshall.
Yes, following up on that last point, one of the problems faced by a lot of young people today is asthma, and particulate matter from buses, the diesel particulate matter, is a particular health problem. The newer buses, as they come online in 07, are going to have more efficient engines and less particulate matter. But if we build in an incentive that says we're going for the lowest possible dollar, we may find ourselves not investing in those cleaner buses, and we may have more health problems, which we'll pay for in another way. There's a balance here, as I see it. What's your thoughts on this, Ms. Lynn?
Chair Flores, Representative March. I have heard the issues about the particulate matter, and I am concerned about the asthma, and we have put into place a lot of anti-diesel policies. I also am concerned about safety features that have been improved in recent years in school buses. So the newer equipment is safer equipment, and you're correct. If we're just going to hold them down so they can't purchase new equipment, in the long run you may pay in other ways too, besides just the asthma. It may be a in some type of crash.
Thank you.
I guess that's my
Representative Dolan.
Don't we purchase buses with a different fund than we reimburse operating expenses, and the fund presently encourages new purchase because you can depreciate the bus. You can either spend the money as you build the depreciation fund up or pay for the bus with the depreciation. But there are two different funds, aren't they?
Chair Flores, Representative Dolan. Yes, that is correct. But let me tell you the thinking sometimes that is in the transportation level. If we can't afford the transportation, then we sure can't afford to go buy buses. And I know a lot of districts in the last couple of years that didn't buy buses, even though they had the money set aside, because they didn't want the public to perceive that they were spending the money foolishly. So they were very careful not to purchase those equipment. The problem with that is they aren't as fuel efficient. They break down more. They take more maintenance. So it can cost you more in the long run.
The point being, though, we have a different fund operating.
That's correct.
There's some political things operating, but this bill would not or should not affect school bus purchase. It's done a different way.
Yes. The answer is yes, there is two funds. However, if they don't have the money to pay the 30% of that, the bus purchase, then they're not going to spend it.
Follow up. I have been in some of those opulent bus barns you talk about. And I really would like to figure out some way for the bus people that I know to reap the benefit of the money they save. And for that reason, I would like very much to work with the Department of Education. Because I know where the money would go if you could save that 70 cents on every dollar. I'm not sure it would get out of the bus barn. I think it would probably, in the cases I know, be spent providing better service. I would like to get that money into the district if we could.
Additional questions? Representative Roland.
I could have this in the wrong, because buses were not my expertise in school, but isn't the amount of money you get each year, doesn't it have a bearing on how much you get for your replacement bus costs? Probably totally separate.
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, the way the reimbursement works is that districts are reimbursed 70, 80, or 90% of their operating expenditures, their qualifying operating expenditures. And if they make capital purchases, which are primarily buses, but sometimes are buildings for bus maintenance and so forth, then they can claim 10% of that expenditure each year for 10 years. So, you know, the money all comes from the state school fund, but that 10% reimbursement, the reimbursement that is tied to capital purchases, goes into a separate fund when it gets to the district, which can then be used only for capital purchases. But it's all state school fund money when it goes out of the Department of Education.
And it's still 70% of the 10%.
Correct, and it's still the 70 or 80 or 90% of the 10% each year for 10 years on the capital purchase end of things.
Claro. Okay. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much. I think we are at the point where we have some good suggestions that we would like to coordinate with the Department of Education on doing some further amendment work addressing the perhaps time for the student measure vis-a-vis the prior year distribution and the annual growth rate index to energy prices perhaps, and addressing possibly the concern that Representative March brought forward in the event it is not addressed in the other crafted language. So, Mr. Keller, if you can coordinate that.
May I add a couple of issues, Madam Chair? That in the original bill, we're deleting reference to students required to be transported for health and safety reasons, or preschool children with disabilities for early intervention. And I think under Americans with Disability Act, we should certainly look at making sure that there's provisions for those children in any formula. I mean, that we have some outs to reimburse for those kind of costs at the existing 30, 70, or whatever rate is determined, or we or somebody's going to fall afoul of the ADA.
We will make sure that we're covered, and thank you very much for that suggestion. Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3178. I will insert at this point in regard to House Bill 3184, and we had indicated we would hear it Friday. Because of the 48-hour posting notice, we will not be able to hear that until Monday, so that you have a little extended period of time.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Talk with your folks. Okay, we move now to House Bill 3162. Open a public hearing, House Bill 3162. Okay, Mr. Keller, please.
House Bill 3162 abolishes the Certificate of Initial Mastery and Certificate of Advanced Mastery, directs the Department of Education to contract with an independent education assessment organization to develop and implement statewide assessment systems, prescribes requirements for statewide assessment system, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005.
And provided in your packet.
We have dashed, we've attached the dash three amendments to your packet.
Okay.
And Doug Costi is here. He submitted a chart that he would be able to come up and explain possibly on the flow of the executive mission master.
Well, it looks like the food chart without the colors. Okay, Mr. Costi, you would like to come forward and address your chart.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, for your record, my name is Doug Costi, Assistant Superintendent of the Department of Education. In listening to testimony and discussions about the assessment system within Oregon, it appeared to me that there might be some confusion maybe not as much clarity around the different components. We talk about the assessment system, the certificate of initial mastery, and the accountability system. And what this chart, and I apologize, it is kind of rough. I threw it together at the last minute.
Not rough. It just looks like the food pyramid.
And it does look like a food pyramid in the way it sort of is. And what I'd like to do is just take a couple of minutes and walk everybody through it so that it helps define the different terms that we're using and the different processes. And I'm going to start, I guess, at the bottom of the pyramid. And on the bottom right-hand side, there are statewide expectations from parents, businesses, teachers, taxpayers, etc., that really drive federal and state mandates. And as you move up the food chain, those federal and state mandates, based on the expectations of our stakeholders, really set and define what our content and performance standards are for the state. And if you move up from there, that's the basis on which we set our assessment system. And the tests that we deliver are by grade level, 3 through 8 and 10. They're delivered in a paper and electronic format. There's two modes of delivery. And out of that delivery, we receive results by subject area, by student, by school, by classroom, by grade, by district. So we can take that data and slice and dice it any way you like. Out of that layer, we have student results, and those student results are then fed back to the school district, and they use them along with classroom assessments to develop the basis for the certificate of initial mastery. So the state tests are used, the state assessments are one component, and the local classroom assessments are another. You have to have both in order to determine or to be able to deliver a certificate to a student. Okay, as you move up the pyramid, you can see that there are two levels of accountability systems that we currently have, and I think the committee is very familiar with those. One is the adequate yearly progress, or we refer to it as AYP, and the other is the state report card. They take the test results and actually crunch the numbers through a formula to derive a rating or a grade for a school and a district. Based upon the results of those grades, continuous improvement plans can be developed and implemented by schools and districts. So this is the system as a whole, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to lay it out and see if you have any questions, because I don't, just again listening to the discussions, I think there have been there's been some ambiguity about the different components of this system.
Thank you, Mr. Costi. Are there questions? Representative Roblin.
Just one. I really like this. It's nicely laid out. For the beginning. And it ends with a continuous improvement, and that is the basic model that we have in the state of Oregon for this whole program.
Mm-hmm.
And at the bottom, you also have, well, you don't really, you just say state and federal mandates. The federal mandate of No Child Left Behind, basically the pyramid stops in 2014, because you're all there, right? So there is no continuous improvement after 2014 because we've all met it, which makes it difficult for me to put this system into that one. Do you see the same thing?
I don't see a long-term strategic vision relative to the No Child Left Behind Act. I see the same thing you see, Representative Roblin, that they haven't thought about what happens if everybody doesn't meet where you need to be.
Further questions? Thank you, very much, Mr. Kopstein. Was there anyone else who wanted to provide testimony before we move forward on House Bill 3162? Okay. Then we will close the public hearing, and we're going to move to a work session on House Bill 3162. For purposes of considering the Dash 3 amendments, and Mr. Keller, do you want to once again go over those for us?
The Dash 3 amendment, it would allow the Department of Education to continue their investigation into contracting out for the assessment system, reporting back to the interim on July 1st, 2006. And it would delay it until the implementation until July of 2007.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I move the amendment to House, the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3162.
Dash 3 amendments, was that?
All three, yep. Dash 3 for me.
Dash 1 works.
Dash 3.
I like that.
I need to go back on this chart and pick up the reading section.
On your feet, March. Okay. Representative Dahlin has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3162. Now we will have discussion. Representative March.
Well, I think we're kind of gilding the deer here. I don't agree with the original bill, and I will be a no on the full bill if it comes, if we vote on it. Just to let you know, and I still believe in the Dash 1 amendments, and we'll be offering those on the floor as a minority report if we pass this bill out.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Rogan?
Just, I had a question. The way I read the Dash 3s is that they have the opportunity, they start looking for alternative testing, contracting out the testing. Now, if in fact in that discussion they can find no test that's cheaper than what we're currently doing, we still have to take one of the contracted ones, if I read it. Is that correct? But it doesn't give them an option to take what we're doing, if I understand that correctly.
I believe you would be understanding it correctly, that it does not provide the option to continue with the current
testing
system, current assessment,
okay,
and testing.
I'm not sure exactly how. I personally like the idea of looking at some of these others, because I really appreciated the material that came from ACT. In particular, I think there's some real benefits for us looking at that, but I worry when we say there is no other option. Sometimes we can do things better and cheaper, and it might be one set of those tests because there's a bunch of tests that we give, and I worry about that. Or at different particular grade levels, we might have a better test than they do, and I get concerned about that. So I'm still in the process of getting all this through my mind.
Understood.
I do believe we need to do some changes. I'm not sure this is one for me, but we're getting closer. Thanks.
I think that concern and that consideration was the premise for which we pushed out the date to 2007 with a report to the interim on the progress. And I think that by within a year and a few months that we would be able to have an accurate report from the Department of Education on what their requests for proposals and or information would yield. And then if we had to do some reassessment, we have another legislative session besides the interim to do some follow-up work and to address that specific concern. If this is the only model that is efficacious for the students of this or of this state to provide literacy and prepare them to compete in a global market, then we would be doing a disservice to them to not consider that. If, however, there is a better way to do business to provide a more positive solutions for our students and to bring them to the highest and best education level to meet the needs of a global economy and all of those very positive reasonings that we want to provide the best education possible, then we follow back around with that. I think this, however, engages us in the very serious dialogue.
Madam Chair.
Representative Farr.
May I ask, partly for Representative March's comfort level, but for everyone's, could we ask Pat Burke from the Oregon Department of Education to come forward and just answer some of the concerns that Representative March has comparing this to the Dash 1 amendments? I'd just like to get the Department of Ed's perspective.
Well, I think that would be peachy. Dr. Burke, would you please come forward?
The mics are on. Peachy.
Keen.
It is. I did not say keen.
No, it's the pear.
Yeah. That could be Perry or cherry.
Thank you very much, and forgive us our frivolity.
No, not a problem, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I am just reading the Dash 3 amendment, so I'm not sure that I am up to speed on the changes between the Dash 3 and the Dash 1 amendments. So perhaps Representative Farr, it might be better if you have a specific question, or Representative March, if you have a specific question, I'd be happy to answer that.
All right. Pat, my question for you is, it seemed that the most serious problem that some of us had with the bill was the emergency clause. And this two Dash 3 amendments that I'm pointing to is that the act would not become operative until July 07, so that's
right.
2 years.
Right.
And the other amendment regarded the reporting of ODE Oregon Department of Education, Iowa Dollar, to the Legislative Interim Committee on Education, just to note the progress that they're making in getting bids from outside testing agencies.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we would support both of those changes. The implementation date in the original bill was, I think, just technically not even possible to have all of the work done by July of 05. As I understand the Dash 3 amendments, that would address that issue. We would also expect and had suggested that in a periodic reporting to an interim committee would be a good idea. The State Board and the State Higher Education Board, beginning all the way back last August, had also identified a need for continuing this conversation. They intend to keep having that conversation, so this would allow, over the interim, an opportunity for all of that to take place.
Sure.
Representative Mark?
Thank you. The other thing that by the Dash 3 abolishes the Certificate of Initial Master. It just doesn't abolish it until 07. And in its place, it has nothing until we come back in 07.
Okay.
Correct.
So they report to us at 06, presumably having made progress.
Correct, but the interim committee does not have the authority to order new changes. So if there are no changes that have been ordered until the legislature returns to session in 07, is there time to implement them by the 07-08 school year?
Madam Chair, Representative March, we have said all along that we are concerned about just pulling out SIM and CAM without having some idea of what would replace it, and particularly what design work would need to be done look at any number of factors. I've already talked with this committee about that. So our preference is that all of that be discussed with the interim committee and any suggestions for changes be made to the 07 session. The other concern that I have, as I've testified before, is one of the steps that was taken originally with this act 14 years ago is the lack of inclusion of stakeholders in the conversation. I don't want to make that same mistake again. I think there's a need for an opportunity for people to weigh in on these issues, not just on the assessment issues, but the whole structure of the act. As I've said before, for example, if Representative Lim's bill adding to the English and math standards or the required courses, required credits, one implication of that is you'd want to look at where does the assessment system fit in that new structure. That's the type of thing that I'm talking about, that we would prefer to have a more in-depth conversation and have those recommendations come for the 07 session and not have a specific elimination currently. Not to say that it would not change or that there could not be changes that were recommended at that future date, but that not be done right now.
Thank you. Madam Chair, in light of the testimony, I would move to amend Representative Dahlem's motion to substitute the dash ones as the amendments to House Bill 3162.
Madam Chair, I have a question for Mr. Burke before we... Is it too late? Or can I go back?
Can you have a question at this point? We can have a... question.
Pat, what I was wondering and what I was getting at is, couldn't we still do that if we did choose, if this legislative body chose to abolish Sim and Cam, couldn't we still do that? Couldn't we still involve the stakeholders and I mean, that would be the direction that I would think the Department of Ed would want to move forward in.
Madam Chair, Representative Farr, yes, either way. SimCam was established by the legislature. You have some choices of what you do with it. Either way, I would strongly recommend that stakeholders be involved. There are a number of other issues outside of the Sim and Cam that would need that conversation, such as the state assessment system itself. We've also testified several times, both here and before Ways and Means, that we are looking very aggressively at the accountability structure, that is the state report card and No Child Left Behind, and how those pieces fit together. Right now they don't fit together very well. We're trying to address that, have addressed it in some significant ways, and we want that to continue. And all of that work has been done in collaboration with task forces made up of stakeholders from around the state. Regardless of what you do now, the future work has to involve more stakeholder participation. It's just the if I'm a classroom teacher in the state of Oregon and I have been implementing the state standards since 1996, to just pull them out or to pull out the system without an opportunity to understand why or what's the purpose, or most importantly, where is it going? What's next for me as a classroom teacher? That's the conversation that we think needs to occur.
Well, follow up. Because, you know, I've been a supporter of SIM and CAM all along, but it appears, you know, that our testimony over and over again, you know, I mean, I think we've only had one testimony in support of keeping the SIM. And the testimony has been overwhelmingly in favor of abolishing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems that that's what our school districts and our constituents want. And I think they may be asking us why we keep having this conversation and when, you know, they're going to see action taken. And so that's my biggest concern.
Okay.
I'm just wondering if we can still make the Dash 3 amendments work within the framework of what you have in mind.
Correct. Madam Chair, Representative Farr, we will, of course, work with the legislature as best we can and try to make whatever you do work in the best interest of Oregon's children. My concern is that some of what you heard in testimony confuses key concepts. One of the key confusions is the difference between testing and accountability. So you can make changes in the testing process and still not fix what appear to be some significant problems with accountability. And they are in two areas. One is the interrelationship between adequate yearly progress and the state report card. There is a disconnect there, and it must be fixed, and we've tried to address that. The other is the definitions, I guess I would say, that go into the Certificate of Initial Mastery. The current certificate requires that the student achieve state standards in all areas or they don't get the certificate. Yet, the state report card and the adequate yearly progress formulas look at a different piece of data. They look at the percentages of kids meeting standard, not the percentages of kids who met standard on everything. So there, even in that definition, there is some room, I think, for further clarification with teachers, administrators, and parents on just what does this mean, and then how does it fit into an accountability structure. And then within that whole framework, you then have the, I think, pretty complicated question of how do we assure you and the voters of this state that students are achieving the standards that we have set for them. And that's an assessment issue and the adequacy of the assessment system.
Okay.
I have one question.
Representative Lund.
Thank you very much. And you mentioned most of the time stakeholders.
Yes, sir.
This SDASTRI amendment requiring elimination CIM and CAM by July 1, 2007. And do you believe you have enough time until the time the stakeholders come back, get together, and formulate the alternative the testing ways?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, I believe the answer is yes, and I would say part of the reason I have some confidence in that is that some of this work is underway already, particularly with the joint boards, for example, who have already begun some of the work. We have a variety of communication groups, both student groups, minority leaders, and communication groups that we have talked about this. There have already been conversations with OEA, COSA, OSBA, and their organizations. All of those organizations have both summer or fall conferences coming up, and I'm sure this is going to be on the agenda in many of those conferences. And I would say the work of this committee has received a lot of attention. People are watching this issue as it comes through this committee. So I think there is a readiness and an awareness on the part of most folks. Failed to mention the PTA. The PTA is a member of some of our conversation groups. People are ready to talk about this. And I think the question is continuing to think about where is it headed, not going back and trying to either eliminate something from the past or to fix something in the past, but to ask the question, we've come this far, what do we want to do next in terms of both assessment and accountability in the state? Those are complicated conversations to have, but I think there is time between now and 07 to make a lot of progress on them.
Okay, can I ask you, Madam Chair, one pointed question, and what is the position of the public the superintendent of education and on this CIM and CAM issue? Do you believe that the last 15 years that the CIM and CAM program has been working, or what I understand is only 30% of the students are passing? I'm talking about the CIM only.
Yes.
And then the CAM has not been implemented because of the funding issue. Do you believe that the cement camp still good things to continue, or it should be eliminated? I'm sorry, asking you the pointed question.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, are you asking me, or are you asking what my boss's position is?
I think what you are saying is representing your boss and the department. Yes.
I have talked with Superintendent Castillo, and I think her position is pretty much what I have tried to outline. She recognizes that there has been both public and legislative concern about the existing system. Is also aware that we've had some difficulty with components of the assessment system. She has certainly directed staff to aggressively try to pursue them and to fix them, and is been very clear about wanting to have the kind of conversation that I have been suggesting between now and the next session. Her reservation is to not just pull the plug on something without having those conversations first, so that part of the dialogue is what do we do next, and that's her position. But she is not at all wedded to the status quo, and has been pretty clear in her expectations of staff to bring people into this conversation and to take steps to fix the system.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Thank you. Any further questions of Dr. Burke? Representative March.
Dr. Burke, in light of that last conversation and some of your previous dancing, is the superintendent aware of the Dash 1 amendments and comfortable with the Dash 1 amendments, and is she aware of the Dash 3s, and if the superintendent were here, would she probably favor one or over the other?
Well, now that's not politicizing the argument.
Madam Chair, Representative March, I don't think I can answer that question. The superintendent has been in Washington, D.C. last week, so she's been out of the state at a variety of meetings. She's currently still out of the state at another meeting. She was at the legislative conference of the Chief State School Officers Organization in Washington, D.C. So I have not specifically talked to her about either the Dash 1 or the Dash 3 amendments. What I expressed to Representative Lim is what I know to be my last conversation with her.
Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
We had you and I and several others had a conversation a week ago, and the July 1st, 2007 date was mentioned, and you talked about the superintendent being out. Have you had a chance to convey that date to her, the date at the bottom of the Dash 3 amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Dolan, yes, I have.
And she is in agreement with that date?
She is.
So the answer to Mr. Representative March's question would be she's aware of the date.
The superintendent was pleased that, first of all, the July 1st, 05 date would be changed, and that there would be an opportunity to have the type of conversation that I mentioned, both of which were things that that she had requested. And she is aware of the date change.
Representative Roland.
Not just to the amendments, but I guess the idea is if we pass this bill, Simicam go away, and then we are looking for a solution by 07 during the interim, and then by 07 we have something back in place. Is that kind of what I'm saying?
Simicam will not go away until 07.
Oh,
and then
during
that process, there is a solution for the betterment being sought.
Okay, so it doesn't go away until then, so we would continue to have the same as we are now until 07.
That's correct.
The whole thing.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Okay, that's what I'm trying to wrap my head around. Thank you.
Further questions for Dr. Burke? Thank you very much. Don't run away. colleagues, I would just like to make a couple of comments. But before I do, I think we have a motion on a sub-motion on the floor to deal with Representative March's motion to insert the Dash 1 amendments, or replace the Dash 3, insert the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 3162. That would be this sub-motion, and that must be dealt with first. So with that, Kelly, will you please call the roll?
Representative Mark?
No.
Representative Lynn?
No.
Representative Roblin?
Yes.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
No.
Mr. Marsh?
Aye.
No. So the motion to insert the dash one amendments into House Bill 3162 fails for lack of majority. We now have a motion on the floor to deal with the dash three amendments to House Bill 3162. Any further discussion in that regard?
So, Madam Chair.
Ms. Representative.
I looked at the both dash one and dash three, and I was debating which one is the best at this time, and I concluded that the postponement until 2007, that's one thing, and then still we need to come back 2007 in session. If there's absolute change has to be done, we can discuss at the legislative session at the time, so still we have time. And so I believe I'm comfortable enough to support the dash three amendment.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. Further comments? And before I have the clerk call the roll, I just wanted to address that whenever in doubt, read the statute. And so I've been doing some plowing through Oregon Revised Statutes, Chapter 329. And the Department of Education shall be the coordinating agency for furthering the implementation of the Oregon Education Act for the 21st century. And also have the responsibility to report to the subject to the review of the Legislative Assembly through a reporting to interim committee, and in developing form content expected for ongoing review, notifying appropriate agencies of expectations, receiving and evaluating reports. That's the responsibility of the interim committee. Also, there is adequate reference to, or I would say quite a bit of reference to, the Department of Education coordinating research, planning, public discussion so that activities necessary for implementation of the chapter can be achieved, and that would be including drawing in the interested parties, not only parents and teachers and the academic hierarchy, but those who are affected by policies that they implement. Further, I think that we are all concerned about higher graduation requirements, and considering the level of investment that a lot of people have made in contacting this committee, I know that you all have received as many emails as I have that are concerned about the efficacy of the current assessment system and SimCam. Considering that our Oregon University system, while it is currently not considering that on their admissions, and nor are our employers, and the recent information about 70% of our graduates are not obtaining their STEM. We did have some reference also from the Chalkboard Project report that we had received a copy earlier, that teachers are not necessarily integrating state test results into their courses, and on and on and on. We have some serious considerations. Is this the best system for our children? And those are the things that I know that the Oregon Department of Education, in concert and in consultation with all of the stakeholders, will be exploring. So with that, I would ask the clerk to call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
This is just to include the dash threes?
No, this is the...
The dash three amendments are approved. Now, Representative, we have a bill as amended. Would you like to make that motion? Madam Chair, I move that House Bill 3162 moved to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dahlem has moved House Bill 3162 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Once again, Representative Lincoln.
Thank you. I do believe that the time has come to make some serious changes, and including the elimination, in my opinion, of SimCam. I think we need to do it in a very orderly way, and I'm not quite convinced that this will get me there where I, how I need to get there. But I truly do believe that the state has spoken pretty clearly. I think you said that. And we as a body have an obligation to do some things to seriously look at it and make it better. I'm not sure this one is where, for me, is going to get there exactly, but I certainly appreciate the work we're doing to get there because I think it needs to happen. So thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
No.
No.
Aye.
No, and possible minority report.
Aye. House Bill 3162 as amended received the required majority and will be passed to the floor. I guess this won't go on the consent calendar. So, Representative Flores will go. Thank you very much for your time. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3162. Committee, those of you who will be joining us, we'll see you in Seaside on Friday evening, 6:30 hearing. And thank you for those of you who will be trekking. I'm sure it will be a most insightful committee. And nothing further to come before this committee. We will stand adjourned.